So this morning, we're finishing out our series called Speak No Evil. And if you have a Bible with you, open up to the book of Philippians, it's the New Testament, and go to chapter 2. Go to Philippians chapter 2. And as you're turning there, I want to tell you a little bit of a story. So the very first year that I started as a high school pastor. So this happened living in another state. This happened in California. I was just talking with one of our leaders the other day, and he was like, "Hey man, all of your stories involve California." I'm like, "Yeah, because I moved away and now I can share them." like when you're there, you can't share them. And so like for the sake of gossip and things like that, which is what we're kind of talking about in this series, there's certain things I can't share in this context, but now I'm two states away and multiple years removed and I can share these stories. Well, one of them is about a guy that at the time was a senior and his name was Daniel. He had a pretty crazy life. And I think that one of the things that is helpful to remember about who he was as a person and is Daniel had a very, very difficult life. In his life, he had very real things to complain about. His parents, he had very real things to complain about them. His living situation, he had very real complaints to give about that. The things that had happened to him, the types of abuse that he had faced, he had real and consistent complaints to give about those. Make no mistake, Daniel's life was very, very difficult. It was hard. I met Daniel because he did not follow any of the rules we ever set up. So we met for our high school and our middle school, we met on Wednesday nights, and the middle schoolers were down on one end of the hall and high school was on the other end. And Daniel somehow always made his way into the middle school section just to mess with sixth graders, like all the time. Now, granted, it's a very fun game called messing with sixth graders, but he would make his way down and he, like, it was like every rule and boundary that we had set up. I mean, even the simplest ones of, "Hey, could you do us a favor and not go into the girls' restroom?" Like that's a basic, don't go in behind this group of people, would not follow that boundary either. And so we, as a leadership team, everyone knew who he was. He was just that dude that everyone knew who he was. And every time we said, "Daniel, bro, you can't carry on a full-on conversation at full volume in the middle of the message." "Well, why not?" "Well, what? It's a little weird. It's incredibly distracting. And like everyone can hear you over the person that has a microphone on their mouth." Like that's how loud it was. And you'd be like, "Well, I don't understand. That's a dumb rule." You're like, "It's not a dumb rule, but okay." And you have to go walk and you'd walk through and explain all this. Well, it got to the point where every single boundary that was in place, Daniel had a complaint about. Every one of them. "Why can't I do that? Why can't I do that? That rule is stupid. Why do I have to sit here? Why can't I talk here? Why can't I go down there?" I mean, it got to the point where the majority of my conversations with him were complaints. And now this was hard because as you looked at him, you saw this one part where you understood that the complaint that he had in that moment wasn't a real complaint. But if you were to have any deeper conversation with him, there was all this other stuff over here that was very valid complaints that I had never faced, and most of the people on our team had never faced. He had faced difficulties that he had real complaints for. And so how did we address these without belittling how do we address these? How do we address the complaints in his life that didn't matter without belittling the complaints that really did? The majority of the Old Testament is written in story form following this nation. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, if you grew up in church or anything like that, you'll be familiar with the nation of Israel, that how God chose to reveal himself was going to be through a group of people. Now, it involves individual stories, like, for example, the story of Joseph in Genesis. But most of it involves an entire country of people. And one of the things that you learn very quickly is that God would choose them to reveal his character, basically what he's like. But at the same time, he would use them to reveal human character, what all humans are like. And one of the seasons in their story, one of the most amazing parts of Israel's history, which is in the books that we call Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua, it's kind of this section where God pulls this nation out of slavery. They've been in slavery for 500 years, and the manner in which he does it is miraculous, and like literally the meaning of the word miraculous. He sends these 10 plagues that decimate the most powerful country in the known world at the time, just bring it to its knees. And then as an entire nation, literally an entire race of people gets up and leaves a country. And as they're doing so, Pharaoh changes his mind, the Egyptian king, and decides to then chase them. But so in order for them to depart, in order for them to leave, God actually parts a sea that they might walk through, and they find themselves on the other end, and now in a desert, wandering or heading the direction of a new home that he has promised them. I mean, if you lived in that generation, you have just even in your own eyes seen things that are beyond comprehension and admittedly become parts of the Bible that people read and go, man, how is it that that happened? How is it that that was even possible? And yet imagine and put yourself in their shoes. You've just seen all that. So one of the things you learn very quickly is how God interacts in their world in a very real way, and oftentimes a miraculous way. But one of the other things that you learn very quickly, because again, he uses them to reveal himself, but also human character, is despite all of that over here, one of the things you learn quickly is that they are constant and consistent in their complaining. They complain, and this is a fair complaint, that they don't have water. And so God does miraculously give them water, but then they complain about the flavor of the water. Then they complain, and rightfully so, that they don't have food. So God miraculously each morning sends them food, but then they complain about the flavor of the food. Then they complain about their leaders, and then they complain that they don't have what other countries have, and then they complain about each other, and it eventually gets to the place where they complain so much about God that he is distant or he's not there, ignoring everything that has happened, that they eventually, and this is one of the most famous stories that exists in the Old Testament, just so that they can feel closer to a deity or a god or just something that they can see and touch, they end up taking all of their jewelry and melting it together into this idol that is this golden cow. And they end up bowing down to that and worshiping that. And one of the things we miss in that story, if you know it, is it wasn't that they were worshiping the cow. It was that they were worshiping God through it. They wanted something they could touch. And their concern or their complaint about God was, he's not there. And so I need something to look at and to see. And so despite all that God did, all they do is complain. And really, their story is our story. Israel exists in Scripture so that we might know our heart. And we are in this series called Speak No Evil, where we're giving special attention to the words we say. And it's not really in truth. It's a bit of a trick to call it that. But it's not really a series about our words. More than anything, it's actually a series about our heart. As Jesus says in the New Testament, he says that the out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks, meaning that the very things that you and I say reveal what's going on internally. That I could stand up here and talk about the ways that we say this or say this, and it really very quickly could kind of devolve into this list of things that you have to do in order to be acceptable. But that will not ever change what's really going on inside, why we say the words that we say. And this entire series has been built upon this one idea. It's kind of actually one sentence or three ideas in one sentence. And it's that our words really do matter. And they matter because first, they reveal our heart, as I just said. But they also hurt or heal, meaning that it is not enough, or it is not enough of God. God's desire is not just simply that things like, and this is where we've been in this series, things like drama and gossip and lying and judging, that it's not enough that God just simply says, hey, just don't do those. But his desire is that we replace them with something, that in the place of those things, we speak words that heal. Proverbs points out that words can be like a sword thrust into a person's stomach. like into the, right into their abdomen. And some of us, maybe all of us, know what that really feels like when someone says something and you can feel the piercing pain of it. And maybe they didn't mean for it to be that way, but it hurt like that. Well, it also gives another example and says, but the words of the wise bring healing. That literally you can bring healing to pain in another person's life. Just simply by what we say. Maybe some of us have experienced that or know that when someone has said, hey, I'm proud of you, or they give you a compliment, or they point out a way you're gifted. And what it does is, I mean, you can literally feel like life being added to you. It's another thing that healing words are called. They're called words of life as opposed to words that bring death in a person's life. And so this series has really been about not so much how do we just simply change the things we say, but more importantly, how do we change the source of, the place from which our words come out of? And this morning is the last week in our series, and we've been walking through all these ideas. And we want to end on, intentionally on this one, on the idea and the problem of complaining. We are complainers. Every person in this room, we're complainers. We're all just going to admit that together, even if you don't want to. We're just going to join and go, we complain. We complain consistently. This, along with, I think, gossip, is probably one of the primary ways in which we sin with our tongue. It is that it is one of those that it can seem very harmless, but it is also probably one of the most consistent. It's not so much that we do it intensely, like a few times, like maybe judging. When you think of like how someone can experience judgment in their life, it is like this hot fire very quickly, maybe very painful, but it's less consistent. Complaining, it's kind of like a drip of water. It's just always happening, and we always can find ourselves doing it. In order to get to the heart of this, in order to understand where the heart of complaining is and why we do it, what we're going to do is turn to the book of Philippians. This is chapter 2. And what I want to do is give you a little bit of context here. So this is Philippians chapter 2. We're going to go through verses 1 through 18. And only like for a small section of this does it talk about complaining. But we have to understand the larger context in order for this to make sense. Okay. So I'm going to kind of walk through this and travel along with me. And if you don't have a Bible with you, we have Bibles in the back. If you don't own one at all, just take that. That's yours. And so it says this in Philippians chapter 2, verse 1. It says, so, if there's any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy. So Paul here, who is the writer of this, is writing to the small church in this Greek city of Philippi and saying to them, if you have any relationship with Jesus whatsoever, then he makes a request. Complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord in one mind. Don't do anything out of selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility, count other people as more significant than yourself. And let each of you not look to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, though he was God, did not count equality with God, this thing to be grasped, but instead he emptied himself. He took on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, being made a human. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient, even to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, so Paul had started this church and then he left, but also in my much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. So Paul writes all of this, and then very strangely in the middle of it, this is still all one thought. Sometimes it's hard to in English to know sometimes what's going on here. Essentially, Paul is writing an incredibly long, because it feels that way, right, maybe in this moment, run-on sentence. It's just one thought, and it's just in order. And in the middle of this thought, he says this: do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so in the day of Christ I may be proud that I didn't run in vain or labor in vain. I didn't work for nothing in your life. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I'm glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you should also be glad and rejoice with me. So here's what's going on. Is that right in the middle of an incredibly long idea around what having a relationship with Christ looks like. And so he writes all these things. He says, look, if you have a relationship with Christ, these are the things that are supposed to come out of that. And then he gives the reason for it and says, this is because this is who Jesus is. And then strangely in the middle of it, he goes, oh, and by the way, don't do anything, do everything without grumbling, which is just another word for complaining, and disputing. And these two words really matter because we are constant complainers. I mean, we complain about everything. If you were just to think about what we complain about, it would fill the entirety of our time here. Like, and that's just me. That's just my life. Like, I could fill the entirety of our time with the things that I know that I complain about. See, we complain about when relationships don't go well. We complain about the mistakes and the sins of other people, whether that be our parents or our siblings or our friends or our team or our life group or people at school or people at church, or whatever facet of our life. It is very easy, because they're imperfect, to find something to complain about. We'll always find something to complain about. We complain when we feel we haven't gotten what we deserve. See, we complain because we feel entitled to something. We complain when things get hard, when things end up being more difficult than we thought. We complain when we have to face consequences. This isn't fair. This is not fair. I shouldn't have to deal with this. I should be shown mercy and grace here. I shouldn't have to face the consequences of what I did. We complain when we aren't entertained. This is a big one for us. The moment that something becomes boring, or the moment it causes to lose our attention, we complain. It wasn't good enough to hold my attention in this. I think oftentimes this is people's complaint with church. They use other words, but what they're saying is, you didn't entertain me to hold my attention. We complain when we suffer. So for some of us, there are real things in our life that are genuinely hard. And we complain that this is going on. We can complain and find something negative about even the very best things in this world. Because one of the things that is hard for us to realize over time is even the very best things in this world have an element of something that is off in them. Even the very best relationships we ever have are imperfect. And it's just part of living on this side of eternity, that because we are not living in a perfect place, and because we are not perfect people, and because we do not live with perfect people, there will always be something to complain about. And oftentimes it's very valid. But what happens is very quickly it turns into a complaint of something that isn't valid, because we get in the mode of complaining. And what we're very, very good at, is convincing ourselves that our complaints are valid as a way to justify our behavior. So when Paul says, he says two things, he gives two warnings. He says, okay, one, do everything without any grumbling, without any complaining. But then he also says this word, disputing. And it doesn't mean fighting. What it means is, and the best way I would describe it is, you know what happens when you are in an argument with someone, or you know you're about to be in an argument with someone? Think about what we do in our mind. What we create in our mind is we begin to draw battle plans of the way that I'm going to convince this other person that they are wrong and I'm right. And maybe we don't even listen to what they say. We do not even listen. So take the most recent argument that you were in at some point, whoever that was with, and think back to the moment, because it likely happened, where either you were trying to anticipate what they were going to say, or you were going to preempt it with what you were going to say. And so what you're doing is actually what Paul uses that word for. It is a word that is used when you convince yourself in your mind that your argument is right. And so we do this. So say, for example, somebody say is coming at you about something that you've done, and you're in this, now you're offended, now you're angry. Well, in the middle of the conversation, instead of listening to them, what we do is we actually come up with the reasons why what they said is wrong and my complaint is right. And this is exactly what we do. We are very good at convincing ourselves that our complaint is valid so that we can behave however we want, so that we can do whatever we want. No, no, you're wrong. I have every reason to be angry right now. Maybe you do. I have every reason to feel the way I do. I have every reason to behave the way I do because this isn't fair or this isn't right or things shouldn't be this way. And again, sometimes that is true. And so how do we as people change a complaining heart without destroying the valid, real complaints we should have? And what do we do with that? How do we walk through that? See, whenever we are building an argument in our head as to why our complaint is valid, it's always directed at one particular person, and it's never the person that's in front of us or that it will be. Every complaint ultimately is directed at the person of God. In the same way that all streams flow back to the ocean, every complaint ever is eventually directed back at God and who he is, every single time. So Daniel one night, apparently he had just had enough. And so I had been serving as a high school pastor for it was 1 month at this point. And I had been with middle schoolers up at that point for 4 years. They were amazing. They were hilarious. And now it was kind of my first time ever now going to do Rhythm of Life with high school students. And so this one night, and how our room was set up was a little different. We had kind of rows like we do, and we had all these tables in the back. We just had one room. It was a little bit smaller than this. And Daniel was all the way in the back up against the wall. And one of our rules that we had for engagement, we said, hey, when we get started, we ask that you don't just hang out in the back. Come forward and just be a part of what's going on. Otherwise, man, why are you here? And so we always had this argument with him. And so finally one night, I think he just had had enough. And he just gets furious at me. And I'm like, and we're starting, countdown timer's going, we got countdown timer's going, worship team's coming on up, and Daniel is just yelling. he is screaming at this point. And he's kind of doing the finger in the chest thing, he's hitting me in the chest with a finger, and he's mad at me. And he's going, man, you always do this to me. Everything I try to do, you tell me I can't do. And I'm like, well, there's good reason for that. But every time, and I feel heartbroken because I know that's the extent of our relationship, is because I have to say these things to him because it's affecting other people. And I'm frustrated because I want to have a different conversation with Daniel than, hey, man, you can't do that. Hey, man, you can't do that. I was like, that's a terrible way to go through life with somebody. And so he's getting angrier and angrier. And in this moment of clarity, and it is not from me, it is 100% something that God was like, hey, you're kind of dumb. I'm going to help you out. And gives me this moment of clarity. And I just go, Daniel, stop. And for whatever reason, he stops. Normally he doesn't, but he just stopped in that moment. And I ask him a question. And I said, who are you really mad at? And it kind of catches him off guard. And again, I'm not smart enough to think of these things. It just was this moment where God's like, hey, I'm going to give you a question to ask this kid. And I was like, hey, what are you really mad at? And he stops. And brilliantly articulates where so many people are at but are unwilling to say. And I love that he had no filter, so he was willing to say it. He's like, you know what, man? And I'll remove some of the colorful language that he used. But he's like, you know what, man? I do everything for God. I try so hard. I try to not be like my friends who are getting arrested. I try to be so hard, not like my parents who their form of income was, they moved in and out of jail because all that they did was sold various kinds of drugs. That was their only income. That was what Daniel grew up in. I try to so hard to behave. And I come here every week and I listen to these messages. And you know what? My life is not getting better. In fact, being here and growing, like, things are getting harder. And what had just happened was Daniel was turning 18 years old and his parents had just told him, hey, you got 3 weeks and you're out of the house. Mom and dad don't have anywhere to live. Sorry. That had just happened in that afternoon. And so then we come in and go, hey, man, you can't sit back there. But for Daniel and for all of us, the two are connected because he's doing all of these things and trying to be good. And yet things in his life are still difficult. And in that moment, even getting more difficult. So why in the world should I listen, obey, and do anything for this God and anything for this guy who says he's talking about God and he's furious? And I go, Daniel, who are you angry at? And he goes, he doesn't do anything for me. Why should I obey a single thing that he says? And I go, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Now we're at the heart of it. Now we can have a real conversation. Because every complaint in Daniel's life was ultimately, even the ones where he didn't just want to obey the rules, was ultimately directed at God, because he didn't really believe that God was there. He didn't really believe that God did anything. He looked at the evidence of his life and said, this God doesn't exist. He doesn't do anything for me. Why in the world would I stop complaining? Why in the world would I obey any of your rules? And he gets to the heart of it, which is true for all of us. Is it the heart of complaining? It comes from a heart that simply just doesn't believe God. It just doesn't. Complaining comes from a heart that doesn't believe God. So think of Paul's argument here. He says, okay, look, if you have any relationship with Jesus, here's the things that should show up, right? He's saying, if you truly know Jesus, if you truly trust in his death and resurrection, it's going to do something in you. And that should include things like that you're going to have unity despite the fact that you're very different people. Your selfishness is not going to be your mode of operation anymore. Instead, you're going to be humble with each other. And then in the midst of this, he says, also throw in there complaining. That complaining is one of the ways that reveals our heart, that there's this disconnect between us and God. And he says, you've got to change your relationship with other people. That should change. And even your very words about the circumstances of your life should change if this relationship with Jesus is in any way real. And what it reveals is a heart that complains because I actually don't believe God or believe in God. So for example, see, when I complain that I don't have enough or I didn't get what I expected, I act entitled, what it reveals is that I believe that God doesn't give good things or doesn't give enough. So I'm gonna complain about that. When I complain about myself, some of us, your primary complaint is not other people. It is how you look. It is how you compare to other people. It is the talents they have and you do not, or the body that they have and you do not. See, when I complain about even how I'm made, what I'm saying is I don't believe that God makes things with purpose and wonder, including myself. It's a belief statement, not just words coming out of our mouth. When I believe that God doesn't actually fix anything, like a belief in God or a relationship with God doesn't fix anything, I will run to anything to find happiness and meaning and worth then. Again, I intellectually know it to be wrong, but I'm just gonna go do it anyway because what I actually don't believe is that God does anything about it. I don't believe that God is consistently good, or I don't believe that he's good all the time, meaning that maybe he was good to me for a little season, but now he's not, or he's really good to other people, but not to me. And so what happens, what comes out of my mouth is bitterness. Like things like, man, this is always gonna be the way. Life always sucks. Like these are things that we say, and it's a way of complaining that reveals that I actually don't think that God is very good. When I complain to other people, it reveals a belief that I don't think that God listens or is even there to hear my complaints. So I'm going to go somewhere else with them. The heart of complaining, the reason those words come out of our mouth is because somewhere deep down, there is something about God, or even just in general, that we genuinely just don't believe. We just don't believe it. Even if we say we believe in God, and we know a lot of things about Scripture, the Bible, and him, what it reveals is there's an area of our life where we don't believe him. And all of a sudden, complaining is put into perspective. And the reason that it matters so much is because complaining ultimately accuses God of being the one that is sinning. Complaining accuses God of being the one that is sinning in our life. Think of what Daniel said. I do all of this for him, and he does nothing for me. In that equation, who sinned against who? See, what he had built in his mind was the argument. He had done exactly what Paul warned against. He was disputing. He was building the argument in his mind as to why God was in the wrong, and therefore he could behave however he wanted. See, when we complain, it accuses God of being the one that is sinning. Paul rightly points out, and he kind of gets to the heart of why we even exist as people. The reason you and I are on this planet is ultimately is to reflect what God is like to other human beings and therefore give him glory. That's why we're here. And anything that doesn't fit within that is ultimately gonna never satisfy. I mean, it can still be fun and great, but it will never satisfy the way that doing that does in this world. That's why we exist. It's why we were made. It goes to the very core of our being. And so for us, anything that doesn't do that doesn't work. And what Paul says is he says, okay, if this is what you were made to do, then complaining removes that light. So if you go back and read verses 14 and 15, he says, your job is to shine like this light, meaning that you just show other people what God is like. But think of what complaining does. It says to other people what God is like. It says that he's not there, or he's not good, or he's not competent. And as I was studying this, I found this quote by a guy named John Bloom. It says this, I think it puts it perfectly. It says that grumbling complaints directly or indirectly declare that God isn't good. He isn't faithful or loving or wise or powerful or competent. Otherwise, he would treat us better, or he would run the universe more effectively. Faithless complaining is sinful because it accuses God of doing wrong. It accuses him of being the one that's doing the wrongdoing. And I will tell you, in my high school experience, this is exactly what I saw. I grew up around Christianity a lot, but didn't believe it. And what I saw among those that said they did was that their life was no better because of how, all that they did was they just talked about how their parents were awful and how circumstances were awful. And they talked about how their school was awful. And they talked about the church they went to and how that was awful. And so I looked at it and went, why in the world would I have anything to do with your God then? Because your God is either not good, not faithful, not loving, not wise, not powerful or competent. And that's what they were saying by their complaints. And so easy to see complaining as this thing that we just do individually. But in truth, what complaining is, it is witnessing to other people that God is a waste of their time. Complaining is witnessing to other people that God is a waste of their time. It reveals that I really don't believe anything. And so the light goes out. The light goes out. Paul says in the middle of this, be lights and do that by refusing to live a lifestyle of complaining. Now, here's what this does not mean. This does not mean that in order to be a Christian, you walk around acting like things are fine all the time when they're not. And I think that there can be that lie that goes out there of like, okay, so what you're telling me is I'm just going to pretend that everything's fine. No, not at all. In fact, there are very real things that go on in this world that we have very real complaints about. But rather than just acting like everything's okay, we have to get to the heart of it, which comes from this place, is that ultimately, moving from a place of disbelief to trust in God's character, it's what heals our complaining. And this does not mean, again, it does not mean a fake facade of acting like things are not, or like acting like things are okay when they're not. What it means is that I take that complaint to a place. I take it to a different location, because trust is an action word. This is not some magical feeling that you conjure up inside of you. Trust is shown by an actual moving thing. I do something about that. And so here's kind of what this practically looks like. And what I, in order to see this kind of lived out in real kind of human skin, turn to Psalm 142. We're going to end in this place. So Psalm 142 is written by David, who is a king of Israel. And if there's anyone that had real complaints in their life, trust me, it was David. And he writes this while he is on the run because the king of Israel is attempting to kill him because David is going to take his throne. God has said, David, you're the man. Saul, you're out. So Saul gets angry, furious, and rather than fixing what's going on in his life, he takes it out on David. And so he says this, Psalm 142. And I want you to hear how David does not ignore what's going on. I pour out my complaint. Oh, sorry, verse 1. With my voice, I cry out to the Lord. With my voice, I plead for mercy to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There is no one who takes notice of me. And this is not a fake statement. In his life at this time, David was genuinely alone. That is a real statement that he's making. No refuge remains to me. That was also a real statement. He had nowhere where he was safe. No one cares for my soul. I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion, the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Please deliver me from my persecutors, for they're too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me. And then this is something that David often does, or oftentimes the Psalms do this. At the very end, despite all of this, he gives God thanks and says, you will deal bountifully with me. That word bountifully is similar to the word overflowing. And so there's two things that David does here that live out and enact trust for us. So rather than just saying, don't complain, let's put something in its place. Let's put something in the place of it. And number one is trust lived out. What it does is it brings our complaints to God. Rather than going to other people with them and just incessant and constant negativity, is I actually bring it to God and go, okay, God, this is what's going on. It does one of two things. Number one is it reveals the complaints that we have that are silly. Like, for example, I mean, if you want to pray about the fact that your phone is freaking out because you dropped it in water and the rice thing's not working and your life is over and like they ain't going to text you, like, cool. If you want to pray about that, fine. But hopefully for a lot of us, what that does is when we're going to pray in that moment, we go, all right, maybe this ain't like the biggest thing to pray about right now. Like, it puts it in perspective. But two, what it does is it brings those complaints and it makes something that strengthens my relationship with the God of the universe rather than dividing that. Is that I actually go, God, this is horrible. This is terrible. I don't know what to do. Please do something about it. That's essentially a paraphrase of David's statement. There's nothing other than that in there. God, this is horrible. Please do something. So trust looks like actually taking that complaint, which is a very real and valid complaint, and bringing it to God. But the second thing he does, and he does it at the end, is he replaces complaints with thankfulness. He says, you will deal bountifully with me. as I was talking with Daniel, his complaint was, God doesn't ever do anything for me. I was like, Daniel, that's not true. That is not true. I said, number one, you're here. And you have found a community of people that accept you and love you as you are. And because here's the truth, he found that nowhere else. And I said, but you found it here. I don't know how you got here, but clearly God brought you here. And I said, every week you break our rules. Every week. And you know what we do? We welcome you back every single week. Every week, people speak into your life. And at that point, there were people that were meeting with them and caring for him and buying him lunch and talking with him. All of these things were happening for him. And all he could see, and again, rightfully so, he had real complaints. These were horrible things that happened in his life. I'm not belittling those. And being thankful does not mean ignoring the complaint. It means being thankful for what exists in the middle of a complaint, a very real complaint. Of saying, Daniel, if you would only look at these things over here and focus on these and thank God for these, this bitter wall that you have built around your heart over time would dissipate because your perspective would change. And he couldn't, and it was hard for him to do that, to eventually get to that place, and he did, which is incredible. But what thankfulness does is it breaks down that bitter wall that is around us. Every night with my son, we do our prayers, and he's four, and so we don't do super lengthy prayers, which is great for dad's ADD. We just keep it short and we keep it simple. But all we ever pray about is what he's thankful for. One, because he's four and his life is awesome. When you're four, your life is awesome, man. His life is filled with Ninja Turtles and Superman and Batman and playing in the yard and riding his bike. And his grandparents got him like one of those like Power Wheels things. Like, I know, it's like a green dune buggy. It's awesome. I just want the adult version of that. I know it's called a car, but I want the adult Power Wheels. Like this is my son's life. It's amazing. So one, he's four. He's got nothing to complain about. But there's this other part that what I want for him is that I want from a very early age for his perspective to be one of thankfulness. I want him to consistently have a thankful conversation with God because admittedly, there are going to be real hard things that happen in his life. Probably not as bad of maybe even some people in this room of what you've had to face, but they are going to exist. And the one thing above all else that reveals God's character, the one thing above all else that at least if things are going extremely difficult that we can focus on is what he has done through his son and his death and resurrection. It remains consistent throughout all of our circumstances. And here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to invite the worship team back up. And I thought it only appropriate that we end our series in this place of thankfulness, that I have no idea. Genuinely, I have zero idea of what you have to complain about. And for some people in this room, your complaints are valid. But for every one of us, we do have one thing to be thankful for, and that is what God has done. And that is what God has done through his son, that remains consistent. And I want to close with this story that I had a good friend. He's a pastor. So the story is secondhand, but his best friend's mom died of cancer. And his best friend was a pastor, and he said he was losing his faith, and it just felt like it was slowly dying. And my friend asked him, well, then what changed? And he said, you know what changed? I realized that I have very real complaints against God at this time in my life, and I'm furious and I'm angry. But I also realized that the one thing that does not change is the fact that Christ died and rose for me. That doesn't change. And I know that can seem like a churchy answer, but it is only churchy if it's not true. And if it is true, think of it from God's perspective, that he has changed the one thing, the most important thing that exists in all of our life. And what it reveals about God is a God who steps into this world and really does something similar to what Israel saw, similar to what David said will happen, and similar to what we know to be true because of his son's death and resurrection. So what I'd like to do is end in this place of thankfulness. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to close out and use this song to do that, that regardless of where your life is at, if nothing else, be thankful for this one thing and let that be our focus over the next few minutes.